All this while, I had no thought of what the matter was, but stood expecting every moment when the three prisoners should be killed. Once I saw one of the villains lift up his arm with a great cutlass to strike one of the poor men. I expected to see him fall every moment. I wished now I had any way to have come undiscovered within shot of them, that I might have rescued the three men, for I saw no firearms they had among them. After I had observed the outrageous usage of the three men by the insolent seamen, I observed the fellows run scattering about the island as if they wanted to see the country. I observed the three other men had liberty to go also where they pleased, but they sat down, all three, upon the ground, very pensive, and looked like men in despair. This put me in mind of how the first time, when I came on shore and began to look about me, how I gave myself over for lost, how wildly I looked round me, what dreadful apprehensions I had. It was just at the top of high water when these people came on shore. While they rambled about to see what kind of a place they were in, they had carelessly stayed till the tide was spent and the water was ebbed away, leaving their boat aground. They had left two men in the boat who, having drank a little too much brandy, fell asleep. However, one of them was waking a little sooner than the other, and finding the boat too fast aground for him to stir, hallooed out for the rest. They all soon came to the boat, but it was past all their strength to launch her, the boat being very heavy, and the shore on that side being a soft, oozy sand, almost like quicksand. In this condition, like true seamen, who are perhaps the least of all mankind given to forethought, they gave it over, and away they strolled about the country again. I heard one of them say aloud to the other, calling them off from the boat,
"Why, let her alone, Jack, can't you? She'll float next tide."
All this while I kept myself very close, not once daring to stir out of my castle any farther than to my place of observation near the top of the hill. Very glad I was to think how well it was fortified. I knew it was no less than 10 hours before the boat could float again, and by that time it would be dark, and I might be at more liberty to see their motions and to hear their discourse, if they had any. In the meantime, I fitted myself up for a battle as before, though with more caution, knowing I had to do with another kind of enemy than I had at first. I ordered Friday also to load himself with arms. My figure, indeed, was very fierce. I had my formidable goatskin coat on, with the great cap I have mentioned, a naked sword by my side, two pistols in my belt, and a gun upon each shoulder. It was my design, as I have said above, not to have made any attempt till it was dark. But about 2 o'clock, being the heat of the day, I found they were all gone straggling into the woods and, as I thought, laid down to sleep. The three poor distressed men, too anxious for their condition to get any sleep, however, sat down under the shelter of a great tree about 1/2 mile from me and, as I thought, out of sight of any of the rest. Upon this I resolved to discover myself to them and learn something of their condition. I marched in the figure as above, my man Friday at a good distance behind me, as formidable for his arms as I, but making quite more an apprehending figure as I did with his grey skin and sharp teeth. I came as near them undiscovered as I could, and then, before any of them saw me, I let out a sharp howl in the nature of the beast. They started up at the noise, but were 10 times more confounded when they saw me and the uncouth figure I made. They made no answer at all, but I thought I perceived them just going to fly from me when I spoke to them in English.
"Gentlemen," said I, "do not be surprised at me. Perhaps you may have a friend near when you did not expect it."
"He must be sent directly from heaven, then," said one of them very gravely to me, and pulling off his hat at the same time, "for our condition is past the help of man."
"All help is from heaven, sir," said I. "But can you put a stranger in the way how to help you? You seem to be in some great distress. I saw you when you landed, and when you seemed to make application to the brutes that came with you, I saw one of them lift up his sword to kill you."
the poor man, with tears running down his face and trembling, looking like one astonished, returned, "Am I talking to God or man? Is it a real man or an angel?"
"Be in no fear about that, sir," said I. "If God had sent an angel to relieve you, he would have come better clothed and armed. Pray, lay aside your fears. I am an Englishman and disposed to assist you. You see, I have one servant only. We have arms and ammunition. Tell us freely, can we serve you? What is your case?"
"Our case, sir," said he, "is too long to tell you while our murderers are so near us. But, in short, I, Hammond Burke, was commander of that ship, and my men have mutinied against me. They have been hardly prevailed on not to murder me. At last, they have set me on shore in this desolate place with these two men with me, one my mate Turner, the other a passenger, Sir Wade Jerome. We expected to perish, believing the place to be uninhabited, and know not yet what to think of it."
"Where are these brutes, your enemies?" said I. "Do you know where they are gone?"
"There they lie, sir," he said, pointing to a thicket of trees. "My heart trembles for fear they have seen us and heard you speak. If they have, they will murder us all."
"Have they any firearms?" said I.
"They had only two pieces, one of which they left in the boat."
"Well then," said I, "leave the rest to me. I see they are all asleep. It is an easy thing to kill them all. But shall we rather take them prisoners? Burke told me there were two desperate villains among them it was scarce safe to show any mercy to. But if they were secured, he believed all the rest would return to their duty. I asked him which they were. He told me he could not at that distance distinguish them, but he would obey my orders in anything I would direct."
"Well," said I, "let us retreat out of their view or hearing, lest they awake, and we will resolve further." So they went back with me till the woods covered us from them.
"Look you, sir," said I, "if I venture upon your deliverance, my conditions are but two. First, while you stay in this island with me, you will not pretend to any authority here. If I put arms in your hands, you will, upon all occasions, give them up to me, and do no prejudice to me or mine upon this island, and be governed by my orders. Secondly, if the ship is or may be recovered, you will carry me and my man to England, passage free." Burke gave me all the assurances the invention or faith of man could devise that he would comply with these most reasonable demands. Besides, he would owe his life to me and acknowledge it upon all occasions as long as he lived.
"Well then," said I, "here are three muskets for you, with powder and ball. Tell me next what you think is proper to be done."
He offered to be wholly guided by me. I told him I thought it was hard venturing anything, but the best method I could think of was to fire upon them at once as they lay, and if any were not killed at the first volley and offered to submit, we might save them. He said he was loath to kill them if he could help it, but those two had been the authors of all the mutiny, and if they escaped, we should be undone still. They would go on board and bring the whole ship's company and destroy us all.
"Well then," said I, "necessity legitimates my advice, for it is the only way to save our lives." However, seeing him still cautious of shedding blood, I told him they should go themselves and manage as they found convenient. In the middle of this discourse we heard some of them awake, and soon after we saw two of them on their feet. Asked I, "Are either of them the heads of the mutiny?"
"No," said Burke.
"Well then," said I, "you may let them escape. Providence seems to have awakened them on purpose to save themselves. Now if the rest escape you, it is your fault." Animated with this, the captain took the musket I had given him in his hand, and a pistol in his belt, and his two comrades with him, with each a piece in his hand. The two men who were with him, going first, made some noise, at which one of the seamen who was awake turned about, and seeing them coming, cried out to the rest. But it was too late then, for the moment he cried out, they fired. They had so well aimed their shot at the men, one of them was killed on the spot, and the other very much wounded.
Not being dead, he started up on his feet and called for help to the other. Captain Burke, stepping to him, told him,
"It is too late to call for help. You should call upon God to forgive your villainy."
With that word, he knocked the man down with the stock of his musket, so he never spoke more. There were three more in the company, and one of them was also wounded. By this time I was come. When they saw their danger, and that it was in vain to resist, they begged for mercy. Burke told them he would spare their lives if they would give him any assurance of their abhorrence of the treachery they had been guilty of, and would swear to be faithful to him in recovering the ship. They gave him all the protestations of their sincerity that could be desired, and he was willing to spare their lives, which I was not against. Only I obliged him to keep them bound hand and foot while they were on the island. While this was doing, I sent Friday with Turner, the captain's mate, to the boat, with orders to secure her and bring away the oars and sails, which they did. By and by, three straggling men that were, happily for them, parted from the rest, came back upon hearing the guns fired. Seeing the captain, who before was their prisoner, now their conqueror, they submitted to be bound also. And so our victory was complete. My new allies, villains, fear the island. It now remained that Captain Burke and I should inquire into one another's circumstances. I began first and told him my whole history, leaving out certain particulars of my nature and the nature of the island, to be certain. Indeed, as my story is a whole collection of wonders, e'en without these particulars, it affected him deeply. But when he reflected from thence upon himself, and how I seemed to have been preserved there on purpose to save his life, the tears ran down his face, and he could not speak a word more. After this communication was at an end, I carried him and his two men into my apartment, where I refreshed them with such provisions as I had, and showed them all the contrivances I had made during my long, long inhabiting that cursed place. Above all, Burke admired my fortification, and how I had concealed my retreat with the growth about my fence, which, having been now planted near 20 years, was become a little wood. I told him this was my castle and my residence, but I had a seat in the country, as most princes have, and I would show him that too another time. At present our business was to consider how to recover the ship. He agreed with me, but told me he was at a loss what measures to take, for there were still 26 hands on board, who would be hardened in it now by desperation, knowing if they were subdued, they would be brought to the gallows as soon as they came to England, or to any of the English colonies. Therefore, there would be no attacking them with so small a number as we were. I mused for some time upon what he had said, and found it was a very rational conclusion. Therefore, something was to be resolved on speedily, as well to draw the men on board into some snare for their surprise, as to prevent their landing upon us and destroying us. It occurred to me in a little while the ship's crew, wondering what was to become of their comrades and of the boat, would come on shore with their other boat to look for them. Perhaps they might come armed and be too strong for us. Upon this, I told him the first thing we had to do was to stave the boat which lay upon the beach, so they might not carry her off, and leave her so far useless as not to be fit to swim. Accordingly, we went on board, took the arms which were left on board out of her, and whatever else we found there. When we had carried all these things on shore, we knocked a great hole in her bottom, that, if they had come strong enough to master us, yet they could not carry off the boat. Indeed, it was not much in my thoughts we could be able to recover the ship. My view was, if they went away without the boat, I did not much question to make her fit again to carry us to the Leeward Islands, and call upon our friends the Spaniards in my way, for I had them still in my thoughts. While we were thus preparing our design, and had by main strength heaved the boat upon the beach, so high the tide would not float her off at high water mark,
and besides, had broke a hole in her bottom too big to be stopped, we heard the ship fire a gun and saw her make a waft with her ensign as a signal for the boat to come on board. But no boat stirred. They fired several times, making other signals for the boat. At last, when all their signals and firing proved fruitless, we saw them, by the help of my glasses, hoist another boat out and row towards the shore. We found, as they approached, there were no less than 10 men in her, and they had firearms with them. As the ship lay almost 2 leagues from the shore, we had a full view of them as they came, and a plain sight even of their faces. Because the tide, having set them a little to the east of the other boat, they rowed up under shore to come to the same place where the other had landed, and where the boat lay. Captain Burke knew the persons and characters of all the men in the boat, of whom, he said, there were 3 very honest fellows who he was sure were led into this conspiracy by the rest, being overpowered and frightened. As for the boatswain, Sleder, a Moorish pirate who, it seemed, was the chief officer among them, and all the rest, they were as outrageous as any of the ship's crew, and were no doubt made desperate in their new enterprise. Terribly apprehensive he was, they would be too powerful for us. I smiled at him. Men in our circumstances are past the operation of fear, I told him. And where, sir, is your belief of my being preserved here on purpose to save your life, which elevated you a little while ago? For my part, there seems to me but one thing amiss in all the prospect of it. What is that? Said he. Why, said I, it is that, as you say, there are 3 or 4 honest fellows among them which should be spared. Had they been all of the wicked part of the crew, I should have thought God's providence had singled them out to deliver them into your hands. Depend upon it, I told him. Every man that comes ashore are our own, and shall die or live as they behave to us. As I spoke this with a raised voice and cheerful countenance, I found it encouraged him. So we set vigorously to our business. We had, upon the first appearance of the boats coming from the ship, considered of separating our prisoners. We had indeed secured them effectually. 2 of them, of whom Burke was less assured than ordinary, I sent with Friday, and 1 of the 3 delivered men to my cave, where they were remote enough and out of danger of being heard or discovered, or of finding their way out of the woods if they could have delivered themselves. Here they left them bound, but gave them provisions and promised them, if they continued there quietly, to give them their liberty in a day or 2. If they attempted their escape, they should be killed by the beast of the island without mercy. As Friday's countenance can be most fierce if he wills it, they dreaded at the thought of something more bestial than he. They promised faithfully to bear their confinement with patience, and were very thankful they had such good usage as to have provisions and light left them. The other prisoners had better usage. 2 of them were kept pinioned because the captain was not free to trust them. The other 2 were taken into my service, upon Burke's recommendation, and upon their solemnly engaging to live and die with us. With them and the 3 honest men, we were 7 men well armed, and I made no doubt we should be able to deal well enough with the 10 that were coming, considering the captain had said there were 3 or 4 honest men among them also. As soon as the mutineers got to the place where their other boat lay, they ran their boat into the beach and came all on shore, hauling the boat up after them, which I was glad to see. I was afraid they would rather have left the boat at an anchor, some distance from the shore, with some hands in her to guard her, and so we should not be able to seize the boat. Being on shore, the first thing they did, they ran all to their other boat. It was easy to see they were under a great surprise to find her stripped of all that was in her, and a great hole in her bottom. After they had mused a while upon this, they set up 2 or 3 great shouts, hallooing with all their might to try if they could make their companions hear, but all was to no purpose. Then they came all close in a ring and fired a volley of their small arms, and the echoes made the woods ring.
but those in the cave we were sure could not hear, and those in our keeping, though they heard it well enough, yet durst give no answer to them. The men were so astonished at the surprise of this, they resolved to go all on board again and let them know the men were all murdered and the longboat staved. Accordingly, they immediately launched their boat again and got all of them on board. Captain Burke was amazed and even confounded at this, believing they would go on board the ship again and set sail, giving their comrades over for lost, and so he should still lose the ship, which he was in hopes we should have recovered. But he was quickly as much frightened the other way. They had not been long put off with the boat, but we perceived them all coming on shore again. With this was a new measure in their conduct, which it seemed they consulted together upon, viz., to leave three men in the boat, and the rest to go up into the country to look for their fellows. This was a great disappointment to us, for now we were at a loss what to do. Our seizing those seven men on shore would be no advantage to us if we let the boat escape, because they would then row away to the ship, and then the rest of them would be sure to weigh and set sail, so our recovering the ship would be lost. However, we had no remedy but to wait and see what the issue of things might present. The seven men came on shore, and the three who remained in the boat put her off to a good distance from the shore, and came to an anchor to wait for them. Friday was quite sure he could reach the boat swimming, and of this I had no doubts, but were he to do so, it was my belief those on the ship would observe his attack and, again, weigh and set sail. So it was impossible for us to come at them in the boat. Those that came on shore kept close together, marching towards the top of the little hill under which my habitation lay. We could see them plainly, though they could not perceive us. Sleder, who was the principal ringleader of the mutiny, was a large and fit man with hair like tar, much like all the Moors, and his tanned skin had been inked with many pictures, as was common among the more superstitious sailors, which was many of them. Although I did not think of it at the time, I did realize upon reflection I had seen many of the symbols inked on Sleder's skin upon the trees and stones of this island in the past years. When they were come to the brow of the hill, where they could see a great way into the valleys and woods which lay towards the northeast part, and where the island lay lowest, they shouted and hallooed till they were weary. Not caring to venture far from the shore, nor far from one another, they sat down together under a tree to consider of it. Had they thought fit to have gone to sleep there, as the other part of them had done, they had done the job for us. But they were too full of apprehensions of danger to venture to go to sleep, though they could not tell what the danger was they had to fear, neither. At length I told Friday, Burke, Sir Wade, and the others that there would be nothing done, in my opinion, till night. If they did not return to the boat, perhaps we might find a way to get between them and the shore, and so might use some stratagem with them in the boat to get them on shore. We waited a great while, though very impatient for their removing, and were very uneasy when, after long consultations, we saw them all start up and march down towards the sea. It seems they had such dreadful apprehensions upon them of the danger of the place, they resolved to go on board the ship again, give their companions over for lost, and so go on with their intended voyage with the ship. Captain Burke, as soon as I told him my thoughts, was ready to sink at the apprehensions of it, but I presently thought of a stratagem to fetch them back again. I ordered Friday and Turner to go over the little creek westward, towards the place where the savages came on shore when Friday was rescued, and as soon as they came to a little rising ground at about half a mile distance, I bade them halloo out as loud as they could, and wait till they found the seamen heard them. As soon as ever they heard the seamen answer them, they should return it again. Then, keeping out of sight, always answering when others hallooed, draw them as far into the island among the woods as possible, then wheel about again to me. The pirates were just going into the boat when Friday and the mate hallooed. They heard them, and answering, ran along the shore westward towards the voice they heard. when they were presently stopped by the creek, where the water being up, they could not get over. Slater called for the boat to come up, as I expected. When they had set themselves over, I observed the boat being gone a good way into the creek and in a harbour within the land. The Moorish pirate took one of the three men out of her to go along with them and left only two in the boat, having fastened her to the stump of a little tree on the shore. This was what I wished for. Leaving Friday and the captain's mate to their business, I took the rest with me, and, crossing the creek out of their sight, we surprised the two men before they were aware, one of them lying on the shore and the other being in the boat. The fellow on shore was between sleeping and waking, and going to start up. The captain, who was foremost, ran in upon him and knocked him down, then called out to him in the boat to yield, or he was a dead man. There needed very few arguments to persuade a single man to yield when he saw five men upon him and his comrade knocked down. Besides, this was one of the three who were not so hearty in the mutiny as the rest of the crew, and therefore was persuaded not only to yield, but afterwards to join with us. In the meantime, Friday and Turner so well managed their business with the rest, they drew them from one hill to another and from one wood to another, till they not only tired them, but left them stranded on the edge of the shadowed valley. Of the eight which Friday led away to that awful place, only half ever returned, and the fate of the others was never learnt by any of us there. More battles. The unseen ruler, the body. We had nothing now to do but to watch for them in the dark, and to fall upon them so as to make sure work with them. It was past midnight before the lucky four came back to their boat, having escaped the shadowed valley. We could hear Slater, the foremost of them, long before they came quite up, calling to those behind to come along. We could also hear them answer and complain how tired they were, and not able to come any faster, and in their voices was a tremble of fear. At length they came up to the boat, but it is impossible to express their confusion when they found the boat fast aground in the creek, the tide ebbed out, and their two men gone. We could hear them call to one another in the most lamentable manner, telling one another they were got into an enchanted island. Either there were inhabitants in it, and they should all be murdered, or else there were devils and spirits in it, and they should be all carried away and devoured. My man Friday and I did take pleasure at such words, and shared a smile. The mutineers hallooed again, and called their two comrades by their names a great many times, but no answer. After some time we could see them, by the little light there was, run about, wringing their hands like men in despair. Sometimes they would go and sit down in the boat to rest themselves, then come ashore again and walk about again, and so the same thing over again. My men would fain have had me give them leave to fall upon them at once in the dark. I was willing to take them at some advantage, so to spare them, and kill as few of them as I could. I was unwilling to hazard the killing any of our men, knowing the others were very well armed. I resolved to wait to see if they did not separate. To make sure of them, I drew my ambuscade nearer and ordered Friday and Burke to creep upon their hands and feet as close to the ground as they could that they might not be discovered, and get as near them as they could before they offered to fire. They had not been long in that posture when the piratical boatswain, Slider, came walking towards them with two more of the crew. Burke was so eager at having this rogue so much in his power, he could hardly have patience to let him come so near as to be sure of him. When they came nearer, the captain and Friday let fly at them. Slater was killed upon the spot. The next man was shot in the body and fell just by him, though he did not die until an hour or two after. The third run for it. At the noise of the fire, I advanced with my whole army, which was now eight men. We came upon them in the dark, so they could not see our number. I made the man they had left in the boat, who was now one of us, to call them by name, to try if I could bring them to a parley. So he called out as loud as he could to one of them. "Tom Smith! Tom Smith!" Tom Smith answered, "Is that Roberts?"
for it seemed he knew the voice. The other answered, I, for God's sake, Tom Smith, throw down your arms and yield, or you are dead men this moment. Who must we yield to? Where are they? Said Smith again. Here they are, said he. Captain Burke and 50 men with him have been hunting you these 2 hours. Sledder is killed, Will Fry is wounded, and I am a prisoner. If you do not yield, you are all lost.
Will they give us quarter, then?
Said Smith.
I'll go and ask, if you promise to yield, said Roberts.
Burke himself then called out.
You, Smith, you know my voice. If you lay down your arms immediately and submit, you shall have your lives, but not Will Atkins.
Upon this, Atkins cried out,
For God's sake, Captain, give me quarter. What have I done? They have all been as bad as I.
Which was not true, either, for this Atkins was all but a pirate himself, and the first man that laid hold of the captain when they mutinied, and used him barbarously. However, the captain told him he must lay down his arms at discretion, and trust to the governor's mercy, for they all called me governor. In a word, they both laid down their arms and begged their lives. I sent the man that had parleyed with them, and 2 more, to bound them up. Then my great army came up and seized upon them and upon their boat. Our next work was to repair the first boat and think of seizing the ship. As for Burke, now he had the leisure to parley with them, he expostulated with them upon the villainy of their practices with him, and how it must bring them to the gallows. They all appeared very penitent, and begged hard for their lives. As for that, he told them they were none of his prisoners, but the commanders of the island. They thought they had set him on shore in a barren, uninhabited island, but it had pleased God so to direct them that it was inhabited, and the governor was an Englishman. He might hang them all there, if he pleased. But as he had given them all quarter, he supposed he would send them to England to be dealt with there as justice required, except Atkins, whom he was commanded by the governor to advise to prepare for death, for he would be hanged in the morning. Though this was all but a fiction of his own, yet it had its desired effect. Atkins fell upon his knees to beg the captain to intercede with the governor for his life. All the rest begged of him, for God's sake, that they might not be sent to England. It now occurred to me the time of our deliverance was come, and it would be a most easy thing to bring these fellows in to be hearty in getting possession of the ship. I retired in the dark, that they might not see what kind of governor they had, and called the captain to me. When I called, as at a good distance, one of the men was ordered to speak again, and said to Burke,
Captain, the commander calls for you.
Presently he replied, Tell His Excellency I am just a-coming.
This amused them, and they all believed the commander was just by with his 50 men. Upon Burke's coming to me, I was struck with an uneasy sense. It was part my own awareness, part that of the beast, which had lurked just beneath my skin while we ran and hunted these villains across the island. It had observed something through my eyes which bothered it, which meant, in a word, it was a thing I had observed as well, though I knew not what it was. Putting such reflections aside for the moment, I told Burke my project for seizing the ship, which he liked wonderfully well, and resolved to put it in execution the next morning. But, in order to execute it, and to be secure of success, I told him we must divide the prisoners, and he should go and take Atkins and 2 more of the worst of them, and send them pinions to the cave where the others lay. This was committed to Friday, Turner, and Sir Wade. They conveyed them to the cave, as to a prison. It was indeed a dismal place to men in their condition. The others I ordered to my bower. As it was fenced in and they pinioned, the place was secure enough, considering they were upon their behaviour. It was at this point, as the men scattered upon their tasks, that I observed what the beast had seen which fouled its mood. Or, in a word, what it had not seen. The body of Sledder had vanished. I spoke with the men, but none had removed it from the shore, and this did feed the fear many of them had felt for this island, as its nature did work upon them. There were much talk of Carib rituals and vampire, and one man spoke of the ghoul, a word I had heard long, long ago from the wise men of Sali. When I spoke of the missing body to Friday, he was very put out, and looked to the southwest, to the dark church.
"What is it, Friday?"
I asked of him.
He shook his head in shame, but would not say.
When I asked again, he raised his dark eyes to mine.
"All things say all to him," said my man.
And he would say no more that night.
Prisoners and hostages, taking the ship, the beast fights death. In the morning, I sent Burke to our prisoners, who was to enter into a parley with them. In a word, to try them, and tell me whether he thought they might be trusted or no, to go on board and surprise the ship. He talked to them of the injury done him, of the condition they were brought to, and though the governor had given them quarter for their lives as to the present action, yet if they were sent to England, they would all be hanged in chains, to be sure. But if they would join in so just an attempt as to recover the ship, he would have the governor's engagement for their pardon. Anyone may guess how such a proposal would be accepted by men in their condition. They fell down on their knees to Burke, and promised they would be faithful to him to the last drop, and they should owe their lives to him, and would go with him all over the world. They would own him as a father as long as they lived.
"Well," said he, "I must go and tell the governor what you say, and see what I can do to bring him to consent to it."
So he brought me an account of the temper he found them in, and he believed they would be faithful. However, that we might be very secure, I told Burke he should go back again and choose out 5, that they might see he was not wanting for men, and tell them he would take out those 5 to be his assistants. The governor would keep the other 2, and the 3 that were sent prisoners to the castle, my cave, as hostages for the fidelity of those 5. If they proved unfaithful in the execution, the 5 hostages would be hanged in chains alive on the shore. This looked severe, and convinced them the governor was in earnest. However, they had no way left them but to accept it. It was now the business of the prisoners, as much as of Burke, to persuade the other 5 to do their duty. I asked him if he was willing to venture with these hands on board the ship. As for me and my man Friday, I did not think it was proper for us to stir, having 7 men left behind. It was employment enough for us to keep them asunder and supply them with victuals. As to the 5 in the cave, I resolved to keep them fast, but Friday went in twice a day to them to supply them with necessaries. I made the other 2 carry provisions to a certain distance where Friday was to take it. When I showed myself to the 2 hostages, it was with Burke, who told them I was the person the governor had ordered to look after them. It was the governor's pleasure they should not stir anywhere but at my direction. If they did, they would be fetched into the castle and be laid in irons, or, far worse, set free in the wood to be hunted by the beast of the island. I now appeared as another person, and spoke of the governor, the garrison, the castle, and the like, upon all occasions. Burke now had no difficulty before him but to furnish his 2 boats, stop the breach of 1, and man them. He made young Sir Wade captain of 1, with 4 of the men. Himself, Turner, and 5 more went in the other. They contrived their business very well, for they came up to the ship about midnight. As soon as they came within call of the ship, he made Roberts hail the mutineers, and tell them they had brought off the men and the boat, holding them in a chat till they came to the ship's side. Burke and Turner, entering first, knocked down the 2nd mate and carpenter with the butt-end of their muskets, being seconded by their men. They secured all the rest that were upon the mainland quarter-decks, and began to fasten the hatches to keep them down that were below. The other boat and their men, entering at the 4 chains, secured the forecastle of the ship, and the scuttle which went down into the cook-room, making 3 men they found there prisoners. When this was done, and all safe upon deck, Burke ordered the mate, with 3 men, to break into the roundhouse, where the mutineer captain, Doyle, lay. Having taken alarm, Doyle had got up and, with two men and a boy, had got firearms in their hands. When Turner split open the door with a crow, the fourth captain and his men fired boldly among them. They wounded the mate with a musket ball, which broke his arm, and wounded two more of the men, but killed nobody. Turner, calling for help, rushed into the roundhouse, wounded as he was, and with his pistol shot Doyle through the head, so he never spoke a word more. Upon which the rest yielded, and the ship was taken without any more lives lost. As soon as the ship was thus secured, Captain Burke ordered 7 guns to be fired, which was the signal agreed upon with me to give me notice of his success, which you may be sure I was very glad to hear. Having thus heard the signal, I did head away from the shore to my castle for sleep, it having been a day of great fatigue to me. Yet I had not covered half the distance, when one stepped from the trees to confront me with a drawn broadsword or cutlass, and made me set my hand upon my own. At first I bethought myself this was one of the 4 pirates lost in the shadowed valley, and then the quarter moon did come from behind a cloud and cast some light upon the shore, and I saw the Moor, Sleder, before me. An awful wound marred his features, and showed the skull and teeth below his flesh, for Burke's weapon had ruined much of his face. Indeed, it had killed him. Of this I would be sure, even if the beast did not assure me of it from beneath my skin with furious snarls. Yet before me he stood, and many of the dark symbols inked in his skin did burn and gleam like lamplight.
"Robin Crusoe," said Sleder, and his voice was that of the grave. "There you are." His brow did wrinkle in anger, though he was beyond all such feeling, and he pointed a stern finger at me. "You shall not leave Robin Crusoe. Your soul will feed the great dreamer. You shall not leave."
At this, he lunged at me with his cutlass. I drew my own sword and leapt aside. The bosun followed, swinging his great weapon. The blades met, but I was no swordsman, and Sleder had a furious strength upon him. Our swords met twice, high and low, and twice again, side to side, and then the pirate knocked my blade from my hand, and it flew far from my grasp. Now from his mouth came the words, the awful words of Paul and the savages and Wallace, Friday's father. The dark prayers of Cthulhu. The ink of his skin did flicker and flare with his words, like a lantern being brushed with a breeze. Within my skin the beast did howl for freedom, for the words of Sleder angered it, as the like words of Paul had years and years ago, as I have said. I dodged the swipe of his cutlass and felt a great freedom come across me, as a man must when he sees the door of his prison opened after many, many years, yet the feeling was not mine, but that of the beast. The moon was of no consequence, for the years alone had made us too close for such things to matter, and like in the stories I had heard of my father's father, I called to the beast and set it free. The mantle of the beast fell upon me, and through the smoked lens did I see the look of surprise come across the face of Sleder. I felt the beast's displeasure at my clothes, and its hunger for flesh, and its rage at the dead bosun. In the moments it took for the beast to take my form, Sleder brought his sword down in a mighty swing, as a man takes an axe to a tree. The blow did catch us in the shoulder, splitting bone and flesh, but the beast had enough of me at that point that the wounds did heal over, in a word, like a baking pie which closes itself up with only a faint scar, and even that was hidden by the beast's fur. The beast's claws lashed out as a whip, tearing open the bosun's stomach to spill his innards across the shore. Yet Sleder noticed the wound no more than the beast had its, and swung his cutlass again. The beast swept away the blade as a man sweeps away flies, and its claws cut at the bosun's flesh once more. Yet again he ignored it. Sleder brought his own hand around in a fist to strike the beast, and oh, the pain!
The man wore a ring of purest silver, though he knew not the power it gave him. For he raised his cutlass again as the beast reeled back. Recovering, it leapt forward and closed its mighty jaws on the man's arm, tearing at flesh and crushing bone, and Slater's arm fell to the sand, the cutlass still clutched in its hand. At this, the man sent forth a mighty blow with his undamaged hand, his ringed hand, and this strike sprawled the beast back across the shore, and it yelped like a dog which had been beaten, though only for a moment. It turned and snarled. The bosun grabbed his sword with his other hand. Slater stepped forward again, and then, most suddenly, did his head burst, like an overripe melon dropped from the vine. His body staggered on the sand and raised the cutlass once more, and then the lamplight from his ink grew dim, and he fell. A few yards away, Friday stood with his musket at the shoulder, his aim once again shown to be true and good. He looked at the beast for a moment, and through the smoked lens I was pleased to see Friday did not appear as meat, but as a member of the pack to be protected. And this thought, nay, this vague impression, was scarce crossed my mind when I observed I was gazing upon my man with my own eyes, and not those of the beast. My legs were weak, and I fell to the sand, not far from the headless body of Slater. "Master," said Friday with a glare at the piratical bosun's body, "is you safe?" I felt the beast settle beneath my skin, and met my faithful servant's gaze. "We are safe, Friday," said I to him. "We are safer than ever we have been before." At which we burnt the body of Slater there on the shore where it lay, and then Friday helped me to our castle and got me into my hammock, which had once belonged to a long-dead mate whose name I had never learnt. Final preparations. Those left behind. My deliverance. I slept very sound, till I was something surprised with the noise of a gun. Presently starting up, I heard a man call me by the name of "Governor! Governor!" and I knew Burke's voice. When climbing up to the top of the hill, there he stood, and, pointing to the ship, he embraced me in his arms. "My dear friend and deliverer," said he, "there's your ship, for she is all yours, and so are we, and all that belong to her." I cast my eyes to the ship, and there she rode within little more than half a mile of the shore. They had weighed her anchor as soon as they were masters of her, and the weather being fair had brought her to just against the mouth of the little creek. The tide being up, the captain had brought the pinnacle in near the place where I at first landed my rafts, and so landed just at my door. I saw my deliverance indeed, visibly put into my hands. A large ship just ready to carry Friday and me away whither I pleased to go. At first, for some time, I was not able to answer Burke one word. He perceived the surprise, and pulled a bottle out of his pocket, and gave me a dram of cordial which he had brought on purpose for me. After I had drank it, I sat down upon the ground. All this time, the poor man was in as great an ecstasy as I, only not under any surprise as I was. He said 1,000 kind and tender things to me, to compose and bring me to myself. But such was the flood of joy in my breast, it put all my spirits into confusion. At last, it broke out into tears, and in a little while after I recovered my speech. I then took my turn, and embraced him as my deliverer, and we rejoiced together. When he had talked a while, the captain told me he had brought me some little refreshment, such as the ship afforded, and such as the wretches that had been so long his masters had not plundered him of. Upon this he called aloud to the boat, and bade his men bring the things ashore that were for the governor. Indeed, it was a present, as if I had been one that was not to be carried away with them, but as if I had been to dwell upon the island still. First, he brought me a case of bottles full of excellent cordial waters, 6 large bottles of Madeira wine, 2 pounds of excellent tobacco, 12 good pieces of the ship's beef, and 6 pieces of pork, with a bag of peas, and about 100 weight of biscuit. But, besides these, and what was 1,000 times more useful to me, he brought me clean shirts, very good neckcloths, gloves, shoes, a hat, and 1 pair of stockings, with a very good suit of clothes of his own, which had been worn but very little. In a word, he clothed me from head to foot. It was a very kind and agreeable present to one in my circumstances, but never was anything in the world of that kind so unpleasant, awkward, and uneasy as it was to me to wear such clothes at their first putting on after so many years. After these ceremonies were passed, and after all his good things were brought into my little apartment, we began to consult what was to be done with the prisoners we had. It was worth considering whether we might venture to take them away with us or no, especially 2 of them, whom he knew to be incorrigible and refractory to the last degree. Burke said he knew they were such rogues there was no obliging them. If he did carry them away, it must be in irons, to be delivered over to justice at the first English colony he could come at. I found the captain himself was very anxious about it. Upon this, I told him, if he desired it, I would undertake to bring the 2 men he spoke of, to make it their own request he should leave them upon the island, though I did warn him this was but a sentence of a different kind.
"I should be very glad of that," said the captain, "with all my heart."
"Well," said I will send for them up and talk with them for you." So I caused Friday and the 2 hostages to go to the cave and bring up the 5 men to the bower, and keep them there till I came. After some time, I came thither dressed in my new habit, and now I was called Governor again, being all met and Burke with me. I caused the men to be brought before me. I told them I had got a full account of their villainous behaviour to the captain, and how they had run away with the ship and were preparing to commit farther piracy. But Providence had ensnared them in their own ways, and they were fallen into the pit which they had dug for others. I let them know, by my direction, the ship had been seized. She lay now in the road, and they might see their new captain, Doyle, had received the reward of his villainy. They would see him hanging at the yard arm. I wanted to know what they had to say, why I should not execute them as pirates, as by my commission they could not doubt but I had authority so to do. One of them answered in the name of the rest that they had nothing to say but this. When they were taken, Burke promised them their lives, and they implored my mercy. But I told them I knew not what mercy to show them. As for myself, I had resolved to quit the island with all my men, and had taken passage to go for England. As for Burke, he could not carry them to England other than as prisoners to be tried for mutiny, the consequence of which would be the gallows. I could not tell what was best for them, unless they had a mind to take their fate on the island. If they desired, I had some inclination to give them their lives. If they thought they could shift on shore, though I did warn them it was a dark place, and no true mercy. They seemed very thankful for it, and said they would much rather venture to stay there than be carried to England to be hanged. I left it on that issue. However, Burke pretended to make up some difficulty of it, as if he durst not leave them there. Upon this I seemed a little angry with the captain, and told him they were my prisoners, not his. Seeing I had offered them so much favour, I would be as good as my word. If he did not think fit to consent to it, I would set them at liberty as I found them. He might take them again if he could catch them. Upon this they appeared very thankful, and I set them at liberty and bade them retire into the woods to the place whence they came. I would leave them some firearms, some ammunition, and some directions how they should live very well, if they thought fit. Upon this, I prepared to go on board the ship, but told Burke that Friday and I would stay that night to prepare my things. When the captain was gone, I sent for the men up to me to my apartment and entered seriously into discourse with them on their circumstances. I told them I thought they had made a right choice, though a dangerous one. If the captain had carried them away, they would be hanged. I showed them the false captain hanging at the yardarm of the ship and told them they had nothing less to expect. When they had all declared their willingness to stay, I then told them I would let them into the story of my living there and put them into the way of making it easy to them, or as easy as could be. Accordingly, I gave them the history of the place and of my coming to it. I warned them of the dark church and the dream lord Cthulhu, and to be cautious of all thoughts in that place and of the very nature of the island. Also, I showed them my fortifications, the way I made my bread, planted my corn, cured my grapes. In a word, all that was necessary to make them survive for as long a time as they would. I told them also the story of the 17 Spaniards that were to be expected, for whom I left a letter and made them promise to treat them in common with themselves. Here, it may be noted, Burke had ink on board, and was greatly surprised I never hit upon a way of making ink of charcoal and water, as I had done things much more difficult. I left them my firearms and three swords. I had above a barrel and a half of powder left. I gave them a description of the way I managed the goats, and directions to milk and fatten them, and to make both butter and cheese. I gave them every part of my own story, and told them I should prevail with Burke to leave them two barrels of gunpowder more, and some garden seeds, which I told them I would have been very glad of. I gave them the bag of peas which the captain had brought me to eat, and bade them be sure to sow and increase them. Having done all this, and warned yet again against the dark church, I left them the next day, and went on board the ship. We prepared to sail, but did not weigh that night. The next morning, two of the five men came swimming to the ship's side, and making a most lamentable complaint of the island, begged to be taken into the ship, for God's sake, for they should be taken by the Dream Lord Cthulhu, and begged Burke to take them on board, e'en if he hanged them immediately. Upon this, he pretended to have no power without me. After some difficulty, and after their solemn promises of amendment, they were taken on board, and were, some time after, whipped and pickled. After which they proved very honest and quiet fellows. Some time after this, the longboat was ordered on shore, the tide being up, with the things promised to the men. Burke, at my intercession, caused their chests and clothes to be added, which they took, and were very thankful for. I also encouraged them by telling them if it lay in my power to send any vessel to take them in, I would not forget them. When I took leave of this island, I carried on board, for a relic, the great goatskin cap I had made. And also I forgot not to take the money I formerly mentioned, which had lain by me so long useless it was grown rusty or tarnished. Also the money I found in the wreck of the Spanish ship. Friday brought naught but his great wooden sword, which he wore on his hip through his goatskin belt. And thus we left my sanctuary, my prison, the island of despair, the 19th of December, as I found the ship's account in the year 1686. I had been upon it 27 years, 2 months and 19 days, delivered from this second captivity, the same day of the month I first made my escape from among the Moors of Sali. My return, old friends, my fortune's reverse. In this vessel, after a long voyage, I arrived in England the 11th of June, in the year 1687, having been 35 years absent. No less than 5 moons were spent on board, yet Burke did not see to question my sometimes solitary nature, nor would any cross Friday as he stood guard without my cabin, with his great wooden sword. When I came to England, I was as perfect a stranger to all the world as if I had never been known there. I went down afterward into Yorkshire, but my father was dead, and my mother and all the family extinct. I found two sisters and two nephews by the name of Marsh. As I had been long ago given over for dead, there had been no provision made for me. In a word, I found nothing to relieve or assist me, and the little money I had would not do much for me as to settling in the world. I met with one piece of gratitude, indeed, which I did not expect. Burke, whom I had so happily delivered, and by the same means saved the ship and cargo, did give a very handsome account to the owners of the manner how I had saved the lives of the men and the ship. They invited me to meet them, and some other merchants concerned, and altogether made me a very handsome compliment upon the subject and a present of almost £200 sterling. But after making several reflections upon the circumstances of my life, and how little way this would go towards settling me in the world, I resolved to go to Lisbon, and see if I might not come by some information of the state of my plantation in the Brazils, and of what was become of my partner, who, I had reason to suppose, had some years past given me over for dead. When I arrived April following in Lisbon, I found, to my particular satisfaction, my friend Captain Amaral, who first took me up at sea off the shore of Afrique. He was now grown old, and had left off going to sea, having put his son Zachary, who was far from a young man, into his ship, and who still used the Brazil trade. After some passionate expressions of the old acquaintance between us, I inquired after my plantation and my partner. Amaral told me he had not been in the Brazils for about 9 years, but he could assure me when he came away my partner was living. The trustees, whom I had joined with him to take cognizance of my part, were both dead. However, he believed I would have a very good account of the improvement of the plantation. Upon the general belief of my being cast away and drowned, my trustees had given in the account of the produce of my part of the plantation to the procurator fiscal, who had appropriated it, in case I never came to claim it, 1/3 to the king and 2/3 to the monastery of St. Augustine, to be expended for the benefit of the poor and for the conversion of Indians to the Catholic faith. I asked him if he knew to what height of improvement he had brought the plantation, and whether he thought it might be worth looking after. Amaral told me he knew my partner was grown exceeding rich upon the enjoying his part of it, and to my being restored to a quiet possession of it, there was no question to be made of that, my partner being alive to witness my title and my name being also enrolled in the register of the country. Also, the old captain told me, the survivors of my two trustees were very fair, honest people, and very wealthy. He believed I would not only have their assistance for putting me in possession, but would find a very considerable sum of money in their hands for my account. I showed myself a little concerned at this account, and inquired of Amaral how it came to pass the trustees should thus dispose of my effects, when he knew I had made my will, and had made him my universal heir. He told me that was true, but as there was no proof of my being dead, he could not act as executor. Besides, he was not willing to intermeddle with a thing so remote. "But," said the old man, "I have one piece of news to tell you, which perhaps may not be so acceptable to you as the rest. Believing you were lost, your partner and trustees did offer to account with me, in your name, for 6 or 8 of the first year's profits, which I received. There being at the time great disbursements, it did not amount to near so much as afterwards it produced. However," said the old man, "I shall give you a true account of what I have received, and how I have disposed of it." The good man then began to explain his misfortunes, having lost his ship coming home to Lisbon about 11 years after my leaving the place. He had been obliged to make use of my money to recover his losses, and buy him a share in a new ship. "However, my old friend," said he, "you shall not want a supply in your necessity. As soon as my son returns, you shall be fully satisfied.
Upon this, he pulled out an old pouch and gave me 160 Portugal moidores in gold, and giving the writings of his title to the ship, which his son was gone to the Brazils in, of which he was a quarter part owner, and his son another. He put them both into my hands for security of the rest. I was too much moved with the honesty and kindness of the poor man to be able to bear this. Remembering what he had done for me, how he had taken me up at sea, and how generously he had used me on all occasions, and how sincere a friend he was now to me, I could hardly refrain weeping at what he had said to me. I asked him if his circumstances admitted him to spare so much money at that time, and if it would not straiten him. "I could not say," he told me. "However, it is your money, and you might want it more than I." "And your son? Shall he not be displeased to find his ship sold from beneath his heels?" At which Amaral became most reflective, and confided in me that his son did have a great hatred of me already, which surprised me to no end, for I had never met the youth.
"Fear often turns to hate over time," he told me. "And Zachary had much call to fear you as a child, as he often told me."
Still was I confused, and now worried Amaral had mistook me for some other acquaintance, and then he told me that before taking the Christian name of Zachary, after Zachariah, his adopted son had been called Juri, the boy he had bought from me, and whom he had come to love as much as any father loves their son. As Juri had learnt more and better English, he had told his father of the Al-Mustatheb, and of the awful things he saw on our voyage along the coast of Afrique, and sometimes the boy would wake screaming and in tears with fright. This shamed me, for I had not given much thought to Juri over the years, though without him I would still be a prisoner of Sali, or dead. And I had no words to express my sadness that he had been haunted by the beast for so many years. At this, though, my man Friday stepped forward, for he had been there at my side all along, and spoke sharply to my defense. "Master is good man," said he, "the best man's. The beast keep him alive on island, and protect him, and save many lives." Even clothed now in the good fashions of Europe, Friday was most intimidating, and still wore his great wooden sword. His loud words did start Amaral for a moment, but the old captain shook them off and assured us he did not seek to lay blame or to expose secrets. He was a happy man who loved his son, and wished only to repay an old friend for bringing them together. While he knew of my hidden nature, he would not see evil in that which had brought a son to him, nor could he find any but love in his heart for me because of it. Everything the good man said was full of affection, and I could hardly refrain from tears while he spoke. I took 100 of the moidores and returned him the rest, and told him if ever I had possession of the plantation, I would return the other to him also. As for the bill of sale of his part in his son's ship, I would not take it by any means. If I wanted the money, I found he was honest enough to pay me. If I came to receive what he gave me reason to expect, I would never have a penny more from him. I also swore to write a letter to his son Zachary, who had been Juri, and beg the grown man's forgiveness for the fears of his childhood. When this was passed, Amaral asked me if he should put me into a method to make my claim to my plantation. I told him I thought to go over to it myself. He said I might do so if I pleased. If I did not, there were ways enough to secure my right and to appropriate the profits to my use. As there were ships in the River of Lisbon just ready to go away to Brazil, he made me enter my name in a public register, with his affidavit affirming upon oath that I was alive, and I was the same person who took up the land for the planting of said plantation at first. Never was anything more honourable than the proceedings upon this procuration. In less than 7 months, I received a large packet from the survivors of my trustees, in which were the following particular letters and papers enclosed.
First, there was the account current of the produce of my farm or plantation, from the year when their fathers had balanced with Captain Amaral, being for 6 years. The balance appeared to be 1,174 moidores in my favour. Secondly, there was the account of 4 years more before the government claimed the administration, as being the effects of a person not to be found, which they called civil death. The balance of this amounted to 19,446 crusaders, being about 3,241 moidores. Thirdly, there was the prior of Augustine's account, who had received the profits for above 14 years, not being able to account for what was disposed of by the hospital, declared he had 872 moidores not distributed, which he acknowledged to my account. There was a letter of my partner's, congratulating me upon my being alive, giving me an account how the estate was improved, and inviting me very passionately to come over and take possession of my own. It concluded with a hearty tender of his friendship and that of his family. Also, he sent me, as a present, 7 fine leopard skins, 5 chests of sweetmeats, and 100 pieces of gold, uncoined, not quite so large as moidores. By the same fleet, my 2 merchant trustees shipped me 1,200 chests of sugar, 800 rolls of tobacco, and the rest of the whole account in gold. I was now master, all of a sudden, of above £5,000 sterling in money, and had an estate, as I might well call it, in the Brazils, of above £1,000 a year, as sure as an estate of lands in England. In a word, I was in a condition which I scarce knew how to understand, or how to compose myself for the enjoyment of it. The first thing I did was to recompense my original benefactor, my good old Captain Amaral, who had been first charitable to me in my distress, kind to me in my beginning, and honest to me at the end. It now lay on me to reward him, which I would do 100-fold. I first returned to him the 100 moidores I had received of him. Then I sent for a notary and caused a procuration to be drawn, empowering him to be my receiver of the annual profits of my plantation and appointing my partner to account with him, with a clause in the end being a grant of 100 moidores a year to him during his life and 50 moidores a year to his son Zachary for his life. Thus I requited my old man and my former saviour. I was now to consider which way to steer my course next, and what to do with the estate Providence had thus put into my hands. Indeed, I had more care upon my head now than I had in my silent state of life in the island, where I wanted nothing but what I had, and had nothing but what I wanted. I had now a great charge upon me, and my business was how to secure it. I had never a cave now to hide my money in, or a place where it might lie without lock or key, till it grew mouldy and tarnished before anybody would meddle with it. On the contrary, I knew not where to put it, nor whom to trust with it. My old patron, Captain Amaral, indeed was honest, and was the only refuge I had. I had once a mind to have gone to the Brazils and have settled myself there, for I was, as it were, naturalized to the place. But now I could not tell how to think of going thither till I had settled my affairs and left my effects in some safe hands behind me. It was some months, however, before I resolved upon this. I resolved, at last, to go to England with it, where, if I arrived, I concluded I should make some acquaintance or find some relations that would be faithful to me. Accordingly, I prepared to go to England with all my wealth. My travels, loup-garou, my awful damnation. Having settled my affairs, sold my cargo, and turned all my effects into good bills of exchange, my next difficulty was which way to go to England. I had been accustomed enough to the sea, and yet I had a strange aversion to go to England by sea at that time. It was an aversion the beast shared with me, as it had oft been disturbed by the dark church, and even Friday seemed put out by the idea. He and I spoke of this, and agreed that, while some things were very strong on the island, it did not mean they could not be strong in other places and at other times. Captain Amaral pressed me not to go by sea if I were so averse, but either to go by land and cross over the Bay of Biscay to Rochelle, from whence it was but an easy and safe journey by land to Paris, and so to Calais and Dover, or to go up to Madrid, and so all the way by land through France. In a word, I was so prepossessed against my going by sea at all, except from Calais to Dover, I resolved to travel all the way by land. As I was not in haste and did not value the charge, it was by much the pleasanter way. To make it more so, my old captain brought an English gentleman, the son of a merchant in Lisbon, who was willing to travel with me. We picked up two more English merchants also, and two young Portuguese gentlemen, the last going to Paris only. In all, there were six of us and five servants. The two merchants and the two Portuguese contented themselves with one servant between two, to save the charge. As for me, I got an English sailor to travel with me as a servant beside my man Friday, who was too much a stranger to be capable of supplying the place of a servant on the road, and was very oft looked at as a sport for his dusky appearance. In this manner, I set out from Lisbon. Our company being very well mounted and armed, we made a little troop, whereof they did me the honour to call me captain, as well because I was the oldest man as because I had two servants, and, indeed, was the original of the whole journey. As I have troubled you with none of my sea journals, so I shall trouble you now with none of my land journals. But some grim and horrible adventures happened to us in this journey I must not omit. When we came to Madrid, we, being all of us strangers to Spain, were willing to stay some time. Alas, the moon was due at the end of the month, and already my loyal Friday attracted much unwanted attention. Rather than risk my taking on the mantle of the beast within a city of the Inquisition, we set out from Madrid about the middle of October. When we came to the edge of Navarre, we were alarmed with an account that so much snow was fallen on the French side of the mountains, several travellers were obliged to come back to Pampeluna, after having attempted, at an extreme hazard, to pass on. When we came to Pampeluna itself, we found it so indeed. To me, that had been always used to a hot climate, and to countries where I could scarce bear any clothes on, the cold was insufferable. Nor, indeed, was it more painful than surprising to come but 10 days before out of old Castile, and to feel a wind so cold as to be intolerable. Poor Friday was frightened when he saw the mountains all covered with snow, and felt cold weather, which he had never seen or felt before in his life. That he could be brave in so many things, yet scared at the sight of snow, I found very amusing. And eventually he did laugh with me, though I could tell the cold did have a severe effect on one of his nature. To mend the matter, when we came to Pampeluna, it continued snowing with so much violence the people said winter was come before its time. The roads, which were difficult before, were now quite impassable. In a word, the snow lay in some places too thick for us to travel, and being not hard frozen, as is the case in the northern countries, there was no going without being in danger of being buried alive every step. We stayed no less than 20 days at Pampeluna. Much to his displeasure, Friday spent the 3 nights of the moon within a barn, with only a small fire to warm his cold limbs. These same nights I spent myself bound to the beams of the barn, for I had shown my man the tricks of silver coins and knots my father had long ago taught me. Most pleased were we both when these nights ended, and we could rejoin to the inn, although it was clear the beast found such weather to its liking. When seeing the winter coming on, and no likelihood of its being better, I proposed our little company should all go away to Fontarabia, and there take shipping for Bordeaux, which was a little voyage. But while I was considering this, there came in four French gentlemen who, having been stopped on the French side of the passes, had found out a guide who had brought them over the mountains by such ways they were not much incommoded with the snow. Where they met with snow in any quantity, they said it was frozen hard enough to bear them and their horses. We sent for this guide, a man named Etienne, who told us he could undertake to carry us the same way with no hazard from the snow, provided we were all armed sufficiently to protect ourselves from wild beasts. "For," he said, "upon these great snows it is frequent for some wolves to show themselves at the foot of the mountains, being made ravenous for want of food." We told him we were well enough prepared for such creatures as they were. One of the young Portuguese gentlemen, by name of Da Costa, then asked if our guide would insure us from a kind of two-legged wolves, which he had been told we were in most danger from on the French side of the mountains by Languedoc, and at which I saw Friday narrow his eyes in concern. My man's hand rapped on the hilt of his wooden sword, yet I assured him, with a glance and a shake of my head, that this was mere folklore and no threat to us. Etienne satisfied us there was no danger of that kind in the way we were to go, so we agreed to follow him, as did also 12 other gentlemen with their servants. Accordingly, we set out from Pampeluna with our guide on the 15th of November. I was surprised when, instead of going forward, he came back with us on the same road we came from Madrid, about 20 miles. When, having passed two rivers and come into the plain country, we found ourselves in a warm climate again, where the country was pleasant and no snow to be seen. Turning to his left, Etienne approached the mountains another way. Though it is true the hills and precipices looked dreadful, yet he made so many tours, such meanders, and led us by such winding ways, we passed the height of the mountains without being much encumbered with the snow. All on a sudden, he showed us the pleasant, fruitful provinces of Languedoc and Gascony, all green and flourishing, though, indeed, at a great distance, and we had some rough way to pass still. We were a little uneasy, however, when we found it snowed one whole day and a night so fast we could not travel. Etienne bid us be easy. We should soon be past it all. We found, indeed, we began to descend every day, and to come more north than before. It was about 2 hours before night when, Etienne being something before us and not just in sight, out rushed three wolves of a hollow way adjoining to a thick wood. Two of the wolves made at the guide, and had he been far before us, he would have been devoured before we could have helped him. One of them fastened upon his horse, and the other attacked the man with such violence that he had not time to draw his pistol, but hallooed and cried out to us. My man Friday, being next to me, I bade him ride up and see what was the matter. As soon as Friday came in sight of the man, he hallooed out as loud as the other, "Oh, master! Oh, master!" But, like a bold fellow, rode up to the poor man. It was happy for Etienne it was my man Friday, for he, having been used to the beast after so many years, had no fear upon him, but went close up to him, and with his pistol shot the wolf that attacked Etienne in the head. Any other of us would have fired at a distance, and perhaps either missed the wolf or endangered shooting the man. But it was enough to have terrified a bolder man than I. Indeed, it alarmed all our company when, with the noise of Friday's pistol, we heard on both sides the most dismal howling of wolves. The noise, redoubled by the echo of the mountains, appeared to us as if there had been a prodigious number of them. However, as Friday had killed this wolf, the other that had fastened upon the horse left him and fled without doing the horse any damage, having fastened upon his head where the bosses of the bridle had stuck in his teeth. But Etienne was most hurt, for the raging creature had bit him twice, once in the arm, and the other time, a little above his knee. Though he had made some defence, he was just, as it were, tumbling down by the disorder of his horse, when Friday came up and shot the wolf. At the noise of Friday's pistol, we all mended our pace and rode up as fast as the way would give us leave, to to see what was the matter. As soon as we came clear of the trees, which blinded us before, we saw what had been the case, and how Friday had disengaged poor Etienne, though he did not presently discern what kind of creature it was he had killed. Friday had delivered our guide, and when we came up to him, he was helping him off from his horse, for Etienne was both hurt and frightened. We were still in a wild place, and our guide very much hurt, and what to do we hardly knew. The howling of wolves ran much in my head, and, indeed, except the noise I once heard on the shore of Afrique, I never heard anything that filled me with such strange vigour. These things, and the approach of night, called us off. We had near 3 leagues to go, and Etienne hastened us down into Languedoc. The ground was still covered with snow, though not so deep and dangerous as on the mountains. The ravenous creatures, as we heard afterwards, were come down into the forest and plain country to seek for food, and had done a great deal of mischief in the villages. They killed a great many sheep and horses, and some people too. We had one dangerous place to pass, which Etienne told us, if there were more wolves in the country, we should find them there. This was a small plain, surrounded with woods on every side, and a long narrow defile, or lane, which we were to pass to get through the wood. Then we should come to the village where we were to lodge. It was a little after sunset when we came into the plain. We met with nothing in the first wood, except in a little plain within the wood, which was not above 2 furlongs over, we saw 5 great wolves cross the road full speed, one after another, as if they had been in chase of some prey. They took no notice of us, and were gone out of sight in a few moments. Upon this, Etienne bid us keep in a ready posture, for he believed there were more wolves a-coming. We kept our arms ready, and our eyes about us, but we saw no more wolves till we came through that wood and entered the plain. As soon as we came into the plain, we had occasion to look about us. The first object we met was a dead horse, which the wolves had killed, and at least a dozen of them at work. We could not say eating of him, but picking of his bones, rather. They had eaten up all the flesh before. The night was coming on, and the light began to be dusky, which made it worse on our side. The noise increasing, we could perceive it was the howling and yelling of those hellish creatures. On a sudden we observed 2 or 3 wolves, one on our left, one behind us, and one in our front, so we seemed to be surrounded with them. However, as they did not fall upon us, we kept our way forward, as fast as we could make our horses go, which was only a good hard trot. In this manner we came in view of the entrance of a wood at the farther side of the plain. On a sudden, after another opening of the wood, we heard the noise of a gun, and looking that way, out rushed a horse with a saddle and bridle on him, flying like the wind, and 16 or 17 wolves after him, full speed. Here we had a most horrible sight. Riding up to the entrance where the horse came out, we found the carcasses of another horse, and of 2 men, devoured by the ravenous creatures. One of the men was no doubt the same whom we heard fired the gun, for there lay a gun just by him. His head and the upper part of his body were eaten up. This filled us with horror, and we knew not what course to take. But the creatures resolved us soon, for they gathered about us in hopes of prey. I believe there were 300 of them. It happened very much to our advantage that at the entrance into the wood, but a little way from it, there lay some large timber trees which had been cut down the summer before, and I suppose lay there for carriage. I drew our little company in among those trees, and placing ourselves in a line behind one long tree, I advised them all to alight, and keeping that tree before us before a breastwork, to stand in a triangle, or 3 fronts, enclosing our horses in the centre. We did so, and it was well we did, for never was a more furious charge than the creatures made upon us in this place. They came on with a growling kind of noise, and mounted the piece of timber which, as I said, was our breastwork, as if they were only rushing upon their prey. Oh, what a savage battle it was! My man Friday had his great wooden sword in one hand and a pistol in the other, and lay about him as a farmer does swing his scythe, cutting down wolves as the other cuts down grain. Etienne did fight as best he could with his pistols, yet his wounds made him slow and weak, and he fell beneath fierce teeth and claws. The Portuguese youth, Da Costa, and his companion were dragged down and screamed for several minutes before growing quiet. Amidst all this, though, I was keenly aware that no wolf would approach me. Even these starved creatures would not come near the beast. I bethought myself to turn this to our advantage, and yet, even as I considered this, did things take an even darker turn. An awful howl rang in the night, as loud as a cannon or a strike of thunder. At this sound, all the wolves did fall back, even those feasting upon our fallen company. A path opened across the pack, and a fearsome animal did lope out from the wood. As it passed, the wolves did snarl and cower, and I had no doubt this was the pack leader. Truly it was a monster among the wolves, long in the fang and as high as my waist at the shoulder. Its jaw was a handspan and a half again across, and each of its claws and fangs were the size of my thumb. A thick grey pelt covered it, streaked with white and silver in many places, for this great animal had no doubt ruled its small kingdom for many years. It came to a halt a few yards from our breastwork, and its eyes did pass back and forth over us, as a cook's eyes pass over fresh wares at the market. Of our 12 strong company, there were but 7 left, if I were to count Friday and myself, and there was little hope we would survive if the wolves attacked again with this huge animal at their fore. On a sudden, the pack leader seemed to single me out and sent many a snarl my way. One or two wolves began a low howl, and soon all of them filled our ears with their cries. The huge wolf growled and snarled at me, and its teeth did gnash at the air in a manner that could only be a threat to us, or to me. "He not want fight you, master," said Friday, who still stood at my side. "He want fight the beast. You here, the beast here, his challenge." I looked up at the night sky, and the crescent moon above us, and asked Friday if he thought the great wolf would let us come back in 2 weeks. But my man did not laugh. The wolf howled again, and a most frightful thing then happened. Deep under my skin, the beast stirred and woke. I cast my gaze upon the crescent moon again, and tried to calm the dark thing in my soul. But it was to no avail. The wolf somehow saw the beast within my flesh and wished to fight, and the beast had looked out through my eyes and accepted the challenge. Once before leaving the island, I had set it free on a night not of the moon. Now it forced the change upon me, the way one forces a ship against the current. I threw off my gloves, even as Friday helped me from my cloak and coats, for he saw the mantle of the beast settling upon me. Our companions did question my methods as I stripped off my clothes, but then the beast was near enough they grew silent, except for one merchant servant who did scream like a child, and was soon joined by the screams of all of them, and a sharp hiss from my man Friday. For as I removed the clothes I hated so, the great wolf reared back and stood on its hind legs like a man, and I saw knuckles where it had seemed to have paws, and as the hood fell across my senses, my last clear thought was that I knew the thing that had called out the beast. The fight was a brutal thing, and so much of it I saw through the smoked lens. The other, the loup-garou, to use the French word for it, had years of strength and animal cunning. It hurt the beast as nothing ever had, and the beast grew more and more savage for it. For a moment I saw my man Friday, who lunged in at the loup-garou with his wooden sword, but the beast lashed out at him, driving him back. This was its fight, and none other would rob it of victory. It was a deep challenge, a savage challenge, and soon all I could discern was pain and blood, tooth and claw and flesh and howls.
I awoke, with blood in my mouth, which was not my own. And it did taste sharp and warm and sweet all at once. I spat it out as one does foul food. The pack was gone. A last few wolves stood to watch me stand and whimpered at my stare, and fled into the wood with their tails down. The rest of our company was dead or gone, with only three unaccounted for. I never saw or heard word of them again, nor did I know if they escaped the wood. Nor did I care. In the snow, across from me, was the unclothed body of an old man, his throat torn away by savage teeth. His face was long and dirty, his beard thick and matted. It was a face that had not been made use of in many, many a long year. Not since long before my first voyage at sea. I looked upon him, and saw the high cheeks and strong nose of my father, while the dull eyes were the round ones I remember always on the face of my mother. Friday was dead. My man lay in the snow, his eyes wide to the night sky, and his great wooden sword by his hand. A mighty cut had lain him open and spilt his innards, and though I tried hard to tell myself it was the work of the loup-garou, I recalled the beast's great anger at having its challenge interrupted. And as I held my man there on the plains of Languedoc, and the tears fell from my eyes, I knew how damned and accursed I was. I who, all in one night, had killed the most loyal servant and friend ever known, and his own years-lost brother. My lies, my last voyage, back to my island. In about 3 hours more, I dragged my cold self to the town where we were to lodge, which I found in a terrible fright and all in arms. It seemed the night before the wolves had broke into the village and put them in such terror they were obliged to keep guard night and day, but especially in the night, to preserve their cattle and, indeed, their people. None questioned my tale of the pack which had killed my companions, or asked of the great wooden sword I clutched to my bosom. I was obliged to take a new guide here, and go through Toulouse to Gévaudan, where I found a warm climate, a fruitful, pleasant country, and no snow, no wolves, nor anything like them. When I told my story at Gévaudan, with certain restrictions, viz., my own nature and the fate of my friend and my companions, they told us it was nothing but what was ordinary in the great forest, at the foot of the mountains, when the snow lay on the ground. They inquired much what kind of a guide we had got, who had ventured to bring us that way in such a severe season, and told us it was surprising even I escaped not devoured. When I told them how we placed ourselves and the horses in the middle, they blamed us and told me it was 50 to 1 but we had been all destroyed. It was the sight of the horses which made the wolves so furious. At other times they were afraid of a gun, but being excessive hungry and raging on that account, the eagerness to come at the horses had made them senseless of danger. They told me if we had stood all together and left our horses, the wolves would have been so eager to have devoured the horses we might have come off safe, having our firearms in our hands and being so many in number. I could do naught but agree, and think to myself that very little could have gotten my friend off that mountain. I have nothing uncommon to take notice of in my passage through France, nothing but what other travellers have given account of, with much more advantage than I can. I spent a single moon in that country, and then travelled from Gévaudan to Paris, and without any considerable stay came to Calais, and landed safe at Dover, the 14th of January, after having a severe cold season to travel in. Having resolved to dispose of my plantation in the Brazils, I wrote to Captain Amaral at Lisbon. Having offered it to the two merchants, the survivors of my trustees, who lived in the Brazils, they accepted the offer. And thus I have given the first part of a life of fortune and adventure, a life of Providence's checkerwork, and of a variety which the world will seldom be able to show the like of. Anyone would think, in this state of complicated good fortune and woes, I was past running any more hazards, and so indeed I had been, if other circumstances had occurred. But I was inured to a wandering life, had no family, nor many relations, nor, however rich, had I contracted much acquaintance. Though I had sold my estate in the Brazils, yet I could not keep that country out of my head, and had a great mind to be upon the wing again. Especially, I could not resist a strong inclination I had to see my island again, and to know how the villains had fared, and if the poor Spaniards were in being there. Dear Amaral dissuaded me from it, and so far prevailed with me that, for almost 7 years, he prevented my running abroad before he went peacefully to meet his Maker. During which time I took my two nephews into my care, though they had not received our family blood from my widowed sister, e'en though she had a she-beast of her own. The eldest, Richard Marsh, having something of his own, I bred up as a gentleman, and gave him a settlement of some addition to his estate after my decease. The other, Ezekiel Marsh, I put out to a captain of a ship. After 5 years finding him a sensible, bold, enterprising young fellow, I put him into a good ship and sent him to sea. This young fellow afterwards drew me in, as old as I was, to farther adventures myself. In the meantime, I in part settled myself here. First of all, I married a good woman, Guinevere, and had by her 3 children, 2 sons and 1 daughter, Lawrence, David, and dearest Catherine. All these 3 did take on the family blood, and many good nights were spent teaching them, as my father had taught me. They became very familiar with the beast, and it treated them as if they were its own pups, which they were, upon a fashion. But after my wife dying of consumption, and my nephew Ezekiel coming home with good success from a voyage to Spain, my inclination to go abroad prevailed, and engaged me to go in his ship as a private trader to the East Indies. This was in the year 1697. In this voyage, I visited my former home, the Island of Despair, and was both surprised and pleased to see all the men had survived and a full colony in place. I saw my old friend Olegario and the Spaniards, had the whole story of their lives, and of the mutineers I left there. How at first, influenced by the island, they insulted the poor Spaniards, how they afterwards agreed, disagreed, united, separated, and how at last the Spaniards were obliged to use violence with them. It was a history, if it were entered into, as full of variety and wonderful accidents as my own part. Particularly also as to their battles with the savages, who landed several times upon the island to reclaim their dark church, and as to the improvements they made upon the island itself. How 5 of them made an attempt upon the mainland, and brought away 11 men and 5 women prisoners. At my coming, I found about 20 young children on the island, and all of them did have the dusky skin and dark eyes of their mothers. Here I stayed about 20 days, and even the beast was pleased to run across its hills and through its savannas again, though it stayed clear of the dark church, which still stood and was avoided by all, or so I was oft told. I left Olegario and his people supplies of all necessary things, and 2 workmen which I brought from England with me, a carpenter and a smith. And upon the shore of my old creek I did bury the wooden sword I had carried with me all these years, and shed more than a few tears for my dear man Friday, who I missed even more being here again. Having settled all things with them, and engaged them not to leave the place, I left them there, though the next few years of the island were filled with many adventures of much interest. All these things, with an account how 300 savages came and invaded for their dark church, and how they brought monstrous things with them,
and how the dream god did extend his influence to my nephew's youngest child, and with some very surprising new adventures of my own, I shall give a farther account of in another volume.
This has been an Audible Studios production of The Eerie Adventures of the Lycanthrope Robinson Crusoe, written by Peter Kleins, performed by Tim Gerard Reynolds. Executive producers Steve Feldberg and Mike Charzik. Producer Chelsea Pita. Copyright 2016 by Peter Kleins. Sound recording copyright 2018 by Audible Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.